at Henry Ford Community College. For more information on admittance and financial aid and class schedules, call the Henry Ford Community College toll-free number at 1-800-585-HFCC. Again, that's 1-800-585-HFCC.
Future musician, eating those fruits packed with potassium and other nutrients can help your muscles work better to play that song. Run, throw, think, eat better. Can your food do that? Find out at smallstep.gov. This is a public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and this station, WHFR.
Looking for a real degree that's going to prepare you for the future? Then listen up. The Alternative Energy Technology degree is great for students looking to prepare themselves for a career in a new generation of green jobs. Students will learn about renewable energy and promoting and practicing of energy efficiency. If you're interested in more information about this degree or any of the other degrees here at HFCC, please call 1-800-585-HFCC or visit them online at www.hfcc.edu.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone, where local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. Now, first of all, I want to talk to you about the International UFO Congress that's going to be held in Laughlin, Nevada on February 21st and through the 27th. It's a whole week of meeting and greeting some of the biggest names in ufology, and people like Richard Dolan and Barbara Lamb, Paola Harris, and many, many more are going to be there. It's Laughlin is about an hour and a half, maybe an hour's drive via car from Las Vegas, Nevada, so you might want to take a little vacation, go out there, and it's a very, very reasonably priced rooms at the Aquarius Hotel. And UFO Congress is a nonprofit organization, much like a MUFON. However, they don't investigate UFO sightings. They just like-minded people who get together and discuss the matter of UFOs and other paranormal activity. So I'm going to be out there, and I hope I can meet you out there. So you can go to UFOCongress.com. That's UFOCongress.com, and check it out. That's February 21st through the 27th. So you still have time to sign up and have a weekend, or have a whole week, rather, of fun. And you don't have to be there the whole week, but check out the speakers list, and you might want to be there the whole week. I know I am. And maybe some of these personalities we can have on the radio show. I know I'm going to do a few tapings, interviews for the TV version of We Are Not Alone. So check that out at UFOCongress.com, and hopefully we will see you out there. So tonight we have a return guest. Today, I should say, we have a return guest in Bill Konkoleski. He's the state director for the Michigan chapter of the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON. Bill was our guest back in 2006, and much has happened with MUFON and the UFO phenomenon in general in Michigan and all over the world since then. And much has also happened with in Bill's life as well. Not only is he and his lovely wife Becky expecting a new arrival in May, I believe it is, of this year, their first, but Bill has written a book chronicling some of his early life encounters with alien beings. And the book is entitled Experiencer, Raised in Two Worlds. And here to tell you more about the book and about MUFON is the state director for MUFON, Mr. Bill Konkoleski. Hello, Bill.
Howdy. Thanks so much for having me back on your show, Dave.
Hey, it is my pleasure. We're about to have a MUFON meeting up here directly, and I thought it might be appropriate to have you back on and talk to you about not only MUFON, but your new book. I bet you're excited about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And first of all, let's talk about MUFON, though. What is MUFON? Tell us about MUFON.
Okay, of course, MUFON is the Mutual UFO Network, and MUFON's the world's largest civilian research organization in the world for looking at the UFO phenomena. Currently, I believe we're right around 3,500 members. I don't have a solid, reliable beat on the exact number, but it's somewhere in that ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the states in the U.S. have a pretty active chapters. There's a sort of a umbrella organization with MUFON, where it's an international organization, though most of the activity does happen here in the U.S. And mm-hmm. so each of the states basically receive UFO reports that are funneled through the MUFON international organization, and then the states go out and investigate UFO sightings that are reported to be in their state. So we have trained field investigators that will contact the witnesses and do reports that we store in a database, for one thing, so that we can correlate sightings as well as find the better cases. There's nobody else out there remotely our size, as organized as we are, that are dedicated, I think, as much as we are.
Okay, MUFON has been in the news lately, I hear, in Traverse City, Michigan. Tell us about that.
Right. There was the local news out there, a gentleman, a reporter by the name of Mark Chalette, contacted MUFON because somebody had sent in pictures to the local news there. The gentleman that sent in the pictures, he was a local photographer up there, and he was taking pictures during the Christmas tree lighting up in Traverse City. And once he was taking a look at the pictures, he noticed some unusual lights in the sky in the pictures. Now, he didn't see these lights as he was taking the pictures, just afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So he reported them to send them into the news and said, check this out. And so the news folks said, what do we do with these? And they looked up MUFON and sent the pictures along to us, and Mark D'Antonio, MUFON's photographic investigator, took a serious look at the pictures and reported back they were, in fact, lens flares. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of light, understandably, in the picture, a lot of colored lights, and he could match one for one the lights in the sky with lights that were lower down on the ground in the actual picture. So the gentleman who sent the pictures in seemed satisfied, you know, that we had declared that what he had taken was lens flares. And so, you know, they got onto the local news January, I think it was 18th.
Okay. But that was up in the Traverse City area, right?
Correct, yeah. Yeah, so it was very great press for us. You know, for MUFON, if it's something that we can identify, that's great. If it's something anomalous, that's always exciting. In any case, we're just, you know, happy to be able to answer questions that people have about what they've seen, turn in data to people that can, you know, spread the word that there is somebody actually looking and taking a very serious look at the UFO phenomena.
Right. Yeah, very often people get confused when they take a picture of the sun and oh my goodness, all of these little orbs around it. I didn't see that when I was taking the picture, but that's just the lens flare from the sun. And they also take pictures of lights. I believe in this case it was Christmas lights, you say?
Yeah, it was Christmas lights.
Yeah, Christmas lights. All these lights, street lights especially, and I don't trust pictures that are taken at night because of the lens flare effect. The cameras trying to compensate for the light in the picture, you know. But so how often do you think you get those lens flare pictures?
Oh, I think quite a bit nowadays. Digital photography has been a blessing. Well, I would say a two-edged sword, because on one hand, taking pictures and developing them by the hundreds, by the thousands, you know, is a lot easier than the old days where you take a roll of a dozen, maybe two dozen pictures over to the photo developing place and you get a hold of it, and then how do you share that with the world? But now digital photography allows you to take so many pictures and get all sorts of unusual things in the pictures and be able to share it with so many people. But so many times it's dust in the picture that'll create unusual shapes or lens flares or any number of things. And also, unfortunately, if you take a picture of the sun, a lot of times there'll be a pixel or two that's darkened in front of the sun in the image, and many people think that's an object when it's really just an issue with pointing a lesser quality digital camera at the sun. That'll happen just about every time.
Right.
And it's also, unfortunately, a lot easier to get 15 seconds of fame by hoaxing a UFO photo and pushing it out there to the public before somebody can identify it as a hoax.
What percentage would you say of reports that we get are, and I say we because I'm a MUFON investigator myself, how many reports would you say as the state director would, you know, percentage-wise, do we get that are out-and-out hoaxes, lies?
It's hard to pin it as a percentage point. I would say too many. If you get one, that's too many.
Yeah.
But
isn't it, comparatively, isn't it small? Most of them are misidentification, correct?
Yeah, very small. I mean, very small amount of hoaxes for certain. Even the amount of misidentifications, if we're just talking about photographic evidence, that's still in the minority of sightings. A lot of times when you talk to the witness, as in this case, Chief Investigator Gary Gollum of Michigan MUFON spoke to the witness that took the pictures, if you can call him a witness because he didn't actually see anything in the shot, the guy comes across, of course, obviously very credible. He says, you know, he never had a deep interest in the UFO phenomena, but, you know, he took these pictures and he just wondered what it was. And so he seems very excuse the pun, down to earth type of guy. And so you say, wow, the witness is credible. The witness is reliable. You know, maybe he really did see something. And it takes somebody with the savvy to be able to look at a picture and, you know, show that it's a misidentification to really resolve things.
Right, right, right. But then there are those true unknowns that, you know, is also a small percentage, but a larger percentage than hoaxes that are true unknowns, wouldn't you say?
Right. And I'll start off by giving out a few numbers here. In 2007, just the Michigan chapter of MUFON got in 84 sightings to us, just in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, 2008, we got 176 sightings into us. So we more than doubled from 2007 to 2008. In 2009, we got, I think it was 252 sightings. So the number of sightings just keeps increasing, spiking upwards, and I think a lot of it's due just to the fact that MUFON's a little bit more known now on the internet, on television, things like that. But when you look at these cases, because there will be times where I'll go out and do presentations at local libraries and talk about the UFO phenomena, I'll generally print off about the last 10 or dozen sightings and share them with the audience. And so many of these cases aren't anything that are easily explainable. You know, the light's doing fantastic maneuvers, close sightings of objects that look nothing like any airplane, and there are a great deal of sightings out there that are unexplainable. And, you know, that's the thing that keeps looking into the UFO phenomena. You know, obviously pretty exciting. And if people say, you know, oh, I understand that Hillsdale, Michigan is a hotbed of UFO activity, or Stephenville, Texas, for example.
Mm.
Well, the reality is if you look at a map, if you were to take, and you can do this actually at MUFON.com, is to take a batch of sightings, say like the last 100 sightings in a given state, and say, show me on the map of Michigan where these sightings are. Where you'll find all the sightings is actually a population map. Where there are more people, there are more sightings. And the sightings are all across the state. And the sightings persist on a fairly regular basis throughout the year. It's not like, oh, it's Halloween, you know, people are going to be reporting UFO sightings. No, the sightings are constant, year in, year out.
Right.
And it seems like the UFO is occurring regularly, all the time, and, you know, there isn't any on-season or off-season or particular hot spot that really has a great deal more sightings than any other. True, I will give it that some places have more dramatic sightings, but in terms of volume, it's all over the place.
So now, as to these craft craft is what they are, that people see that seem to, you know, up close and personal, seem to defy the laws of physics and defy the laws of aerodynamics. And a lot of people say, oh, that's probably our own government's prototypes, you know, flying overhead in a residential area. What do you say to that?
It's possible in some cases. There are sort of threshold sightings, as I would consider them, where it wouldn't be completely beyond the capacity of our government to have secret aircraft that can do some pretty fancy maneuvers.
Right.
And so in some cases, I think it is possible. In particular, triangle sightings.
Right.
Triangles seem to be the type of craft that is most often photographed or videoed.
Right.
With some degree of quality. A lot of disc pictures and video just seems to, you see a light that just sort of jumps all over the place. But there's some great footage out there of triangles. And when you look at some of these things, you say, that's, you know, like nothing that I know is out there in the sky, but really it's not beyond the capacity of our government to build something like that. And, you know, just not let people know that that is their cutting-edge technology.
Right. But I'll agree with that. I mean, I do believe some of these triangles are ours. But whether or not they got the idea and got the ability to do so as a result of reverse engineering from crash disks, or if we're just that smart. But would they fly these prototypes? Number one, if they're prototypes, they're, I would say they're pretty much out of the prototype stage and ready for use in the Middle East. But would they fly these prototypes over residential areas, heavily populated areas?
Yeah, that's a tough one. My thinking, well, really ultimately, I don't know. I can't speak on behalf of the government or some of the goofy things that the government or military could, you know, what they're capable of in their wide array of missteps. But if they don't think that people can see them, then maybe they do take a little extra dare or two and appear someplace where they don't think they're being seen, but yet there's a handful of witnesses. And
like Phoenix, and, Arizona?
Mm-hmm. Something like, yeah. Yeah, pretty much along those lines, yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty dramatic. So if someone here, well, you know, this show's going out all over the world, on the internet, but it's also going out on the radio in here in Dearborn, in the Dearborn area, Detroit area. If someone sees, someone within the sound of our voices, sees something in the sky that they can't quite identify, they feel, well, you know, it is an unidentified to them object that is flying. Where do they report it? Here in Michigan, for example, would they report it to Michigan MUFON or MUFON headquarters?
The headquarters is the way station for all sightings. What will happen is if you see something, it's best to actually report it online. Better than phoning somebody or writing up a report and mailing it in the mail, anything along those lines. Because when you report it to our website, it gets processed much faster, goes to the right person in the right state that's capable of investigating the report. And also, when it's reported at our website, the witness is actually inputting information directly into our database. So there's no middleman that could get confused, mistype things, or anything along those lines.
Right.
You are putting, as a witness, are putting information directly in the database, what you saw.
Right. Very good. And what is that website that they would report to?
MUFON.com, MUFON.com.
MUFON.com, standing for Mutual UFO Network, correct? Mm. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to have to take just a short break to remind our listeners that you are listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. We're speaking with the state director for the Michigan chapter of the Mutual UFO Network, Mr. William Konkoleski, Bill Konkoleski. And Bill has just written a book entitled Experiencer, Raised in Two Worlds. Tell us about that book, Bill.
Well, the way I got into MUFON, actually, is that I'd had personal experiences, very high strangeness personal experiences, and I didn't know where to turn to tell people about them. Mm-hmm. And so when I got old enough, because these things have been happening to me all my life, I was able to get in contact with my local MUFON chapter here in Michigan, tell my story, had the benefit of being able to be put under hypnotic regression and unearth a few more details than I could remember on the surface, and collect my thoughts ultimately at one point, and I started putting it down mostly for my own sake, because a lot of these things that happened to me were several decades ago, and so I wanted to write it down, put my thoughts down, and so sort of a personal journal of a lot of the unusual things that have happened to me in my life, as well as many people were asking me, oh, I heard you had a sort of a strange encounter. Could you tell me about that? Well, when you have your whole life filled with strange encounters, where do you start? And how much, you know, do you tell? And I found the easiest way for me is to put everything down in a book form, and beyond the people that I know, share with anybody else out there who is actually interested in reading my story.
Right.
Now, with the audience that you have, I guess I can pretty much cut to the chase and say that I'm an experiencer, hence the title of the book. Abductee is another term for experiencer in many ways.
What is the difference, Bill?
Well, abductee posits a negative encounter, I would say, where the person is totally unwillingly, taken from someplace, actually physically abducted. I'm taking you somewhere else, you are being abducted. Where the experiencer, the encounters aren't always negative, I would say, with that connotation, as well as the person who experiences, the phenomena, it's not always negative, they're not always taken away, it's a sort of a broader interpretation of encountering a high strangeness phenomena rather than the very sort of sinister nuance that a word like abduction or abductee has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your first experience then that you consciously remember, this is the way you start your book. I don't want to give away the whole book, but let's dip in a little bit into that book. Your first experience, what happened?
I was 2, and I was in a crib in the house where I was growing up, of course, and my parents were in the room across the hallway, and as I was laying there, it was late at night, a little gray guy came into my room and peered down at me over the foot of my crib. And as I screamed for my parents, they basically just told me to go back to sleep. It was nothing. But the little guy was still there. I was totally awake. My parents and I were talking to each other through the wall, and there was a little gray guy there. And after a few seconds, he stepped out of the room and I believe was on his way to my brother's room, but I'm not 100% certain because I was, you know, small and in a crib, so I couldn't actually see where he was going, even if I wanted to follow him. But so my very first memory is that memory in the crib. And it's not anything that many years later I look back and say, you know, I think I have a memory of this. It stayed with me my whole life.
No.
From that moment on, I never forgot it.
Yeah.
And when I was older, in my 20s, and sought hypnotic regression about the situation, I was a bit leery about hypnosis, whether or not I would be a good hypnotic subject, whether or not the person who was hypnotizing me would ask leading questions, you know, things along those lines, or if I would actually make stuff up, oh my gosh, under hypnosis that didn't really happen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I actually got under hypnosis, and it was under the very competent state-licensed hypnotherapist that she was, Shirley Coyne, who was the former state director of MUFON, when she took me under hypnosis, I found that I to be very much in control, first of all. And secondly, I remembered things under hypnosis that were in my room that were actually things that I had forgotten about over the years, but hypnosis brought me back to remember things correctly. In specific, at the foot of my crib, I had always, through my life, sort of remembered that there were bars at the foot of my crib, when in fact, when I was under hypnosis, there was a flat board at the foot of my crib. when I tried to remember the situation. And as hard as I tried, I couldn't turn this flat board into bars as I thought there should be. And so when I came out of hypnosis, I was like, you know, Shirley, you know, I don't know about this hypnosis thing, because when I tried to remember my crib correctly as there being bars, all I saw was a flat board. And so when I got home, I was still living at home with my parents at the time, when I mentioned the hypnosis session to my mom, she said, well, your crib is still upstairs in the attic if you want to take a look at it. And sure enough, yeah, it was a flat board at the foot of the crib.
Hmm.
So hypnosis forced me to remember something accurately, even though I fought it, to try to remember it how I thought I remembered it.
So how trustworthy would you say that would you feel that hypnosis is in verifying your experiences, not just based on that one incident, but on several or other people's experience with hypnosis?
The best I could do is speak personally, and that is to say that I went under several hypnotic regression sessions with Shirley, and at a later date, actually with some another person that had regressed me. And after you get through that first hypnosis session where you're in a mild panic almost,
mm-hmm.
because you don't know if, you know, they're going to turn you into a chicken or, you know, whatever, or, you know, any sort of shenanigans or...
That's Hollywood.
How things are going to be.
That's Hollywood.
Yep. So, but when you go through the situation and you're relaxed and it's fruitful and you come out of it and you say, hey, you know, that wasn't as bad as it could be. Yeah, I remembered some pretty scary stuff, but I always felt a degree of control over what was happening to me. And... I knew what I was seeing was, I guess, fairly grounded and accurate. You know, for me, when I was under hypnosis, a couple times I tried to play with it and tried to put things in the picture,
right,
so to speak, and things didn't really stick. For me, hypnosis kept me very focused, very on task, very honest with myself. In fact, like I said, in the situation of the crib, and that's only part of my first experience, but it was very correcting of me when I tried to remember things incorrectly.
Okay.
So for me, hypnosis was a wonderful tool and a great tool. If I hadn't experienced hypnosis the way I had and was able to verify for myself how good it was, I could see how any reasonable person might question how good hypnosis works, but I can only give myself testimony and say that it's good stuff.
Okay, a lot of people are afraid to undergo hypnosis because they're afraid. They say, "I don't want someone else in control of my mind." How do you answer them?
Well, I can't speak to like talented stage hypnotists in in a place like Vegas or something like that. But the type, if you have a caring person, serious, somebody who's got the proper license and things along those lines,
right,
you can basically, while you're, especially during that first hypnosis session, sort of get the feel of who this is that's putting you under hypnosis. You can tell where they push the envelope a little bit and start to ask maybe leading questions. And if that's the case, you can say, oh, okay, I understand what's going on now. And if you receive a leading question, just like you would when you're perfectly, out of hypnosis, you're up and about, you understand when somebody's asking you a leading question and you don't take the bait. So when you're under hypnosis, it's no different. You're really much more in control than you probably think you would be.
All right. Like in the case of Betty and Barney Hill, the hypnotist tried to lead them away from an alien abduction type scenario, and they refused to go there because, that's what happened to them. So that's what they reported. One other thing, you mentioned that you have a chapter in your book, Experiencer, Flying Lessons. Tell us about that.
not long after that one experience that I'd had in the crib, a couple years later, actually, when I was four, I was at home with my mother, and it was a warm spring day, and so she had gone out, my mom, in the front yard to do some weeding of the yard where I just wanted to nap, so I hopped in bed while she was out there doing that.
How old were you then?
I'm sorry?
How old were you then?
Oh, 4 years old.
Oh, okay.
Yep, so, yeah, I went down for a nap, and she was just right outside, basically, weeding in the front yard. And so when I right pretty much when I laid down, I felt a full body tingle. My whole body felt like it had a slight electrical current running through it. And it was a very unusual situation, you know, as it would always be. But for somebody as young as I was, you know, there weren't any words for that. You know, things like sleep paralysis or out-of-body experiences, you know, things like that weren't familiar to me. But what had happened at that moment, as I started to feel the full body tingle, I suddenly felt like I was being pulled out of my body, almost like a handkerchief being, like, plucked out of a pocket. And I was deposited in my room, and there were three little gray guys in there with me, and they seemed very friendly. They seemed like little playmates. They didn't seem ominous or scary, kind of whimsical, you know, very, very playful. And so they led me out of the room, and my bedroom at the time was on the second floor of the house. And so they asked me to lay down on my stomach, so I did that. And two of them went down the stairs into the living room, and the one next to me said, "Okay, now fly down to the other guys." And so I was just like, wow, you know, and I felt myself actually levitate about a foot off the ground and dive face first down the stairs and land in sort of a falling leaf motion in the living room. And they were all so delighted, jumping up and down and around me. At this point, all three of them were around me and very excited. And I was, you know, I was loving it. And so I'm like, that's great, you know. And so they're like, okay, you know, you have to go, you know, back to bed now, kind of a thing. And I was like, well, I want to tell my mom. And they're like, oh, no, 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 this is just between us. And I thought that was kind of unusual. I'm like, that was a real kind of a bummer because, you know, as a little kid, you do something really exciting. Of course you want to tell your mom. And they were like, you know, no, probably no, no, just don't do that. So then a moment later, everything blacked out, and I felt the full body tingle again. And then I was in bed, and so I got out of bed, and I looked around the house, and the little gray guys were gone. And so I decided I would try to fly down the stairs again. And so I crawled, I went to the top of the stairs, laid on my stomach, and I, you know, I obviously couldn't levitate anymore or fly down the stairs.
Right.
Yeah, I ended up just crawling down the stairs face first, and wasn't the same.
And mom says, "What in the world are you doing here?"
and it wasn't really until, you know, I started putting this book together many years later that, you know, she found out about it because I didn't ever really tell her.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, you didn't go onto the top step, the landing, and jump. You know, laid down. But this was definitely an out-of-body experience then, right? So it's another dimensional situation. Do you feel that all of your abduction experiences have been out-of-body, have been other-dimensional, or have there any of them or all of them, well, I'm going to have to say any of them, been physical?
Well, to start with, my experience at 2 years old was very physical. I saw the thing. I was awake. I screamed for my mom. Mm. She, you know, she called back to go back to sleep. A few years later, after my experience at 4 years old, I was taken into a craft, and actually, they cut my arm, and I still have the scar. So that was definitely a very physical experience there. In my teen years, there were many experiences that I would put in the out-of-body category. Now, the thing about it is that somebody who's pretty far removed from the abduction phenomena is going to say, so what is it? Is it an out-of-body experience or is it real? You can't tell me that it's both, you know, but yeah, I hate to, you know, make a judgment call on it. I just say that pretty much, you know, I've had experiences that were clearly out of body with them. Mm. I had experiences that were clearly very physical with them. How it is that they can manage to come to a witness in either physical or astral, if you want to use that word, form.
Right.
You know, I don't know. But then again, you know, if they have the technology to come to our planet from who knows where, then who knows what they're capable of.
Is it possible that some of them are physical and some of them are spiritual? Or on the astral plane?
I would say it seems that way. Yeah. I would hate to... It's almost that when you have these types of experiences, mm. and you have the variety of experiences that I guess I've gone through, language doesn't serve you very well sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough to you know, make any definitive statements about anything. You could say, oh, they fly around in spaceships, but how is it that they're able to enter a house where there's no place to park the spaceship? However, there have been times where I've seen a spaceship, you know, if that's what you want to call it, some form of craft, you know, near my house.
Near your
floating
house.
Over my house. So.
Right, right.
You try to box it in, it resists, and it's just all pervasive, and it's very strange, and it's one of the things that makes it very difficult to, one, explain the phenomena, you know, and then to try to get beyond that to convince somebody of the reality of it,
right.
Because they'll say that they're, you know, all you're doing is throwing at them paradoxes, that you're contradicting yourself.
Mm.
That, you know, you seem confused yourself, so, you know, how am I supposed to take what you say? But it's just that way.
Yeah, it is a very confusing phenomenon. I'm going to have to take one more break to remind our listeners that you are listening to WHFR.FM with a station making waves. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell. We're speaking with State Director of Michigan MUFON, Mr. Bill Konkoleski. He's the author of Experiencer, Raised in Two Worlds. And I want to mention again MUFON's. Now, MUFON's headquarters email, or rather URL, is MUFON.com, right?
Correct.
And what about Michigan MUFON? What if people wanted to get in touch here in Michigan with the Michigan chapter?
Certainly, and that's MIMUFON.org.
So MIMUFON.org.
Yep. And, and on that note, if anybody's interested in seeing the coverage from the Traverse City sighting, mm. There's a link to it actually on the MIMUFON.org webpage, right on the top of the homepage.
Ah, good. Yeah, that would be good. And anybody wants to join MUFON or check it out, to go to mimufon.org. And quite an organization. I've been with it for quite some time now. Haven't regretted it yet. And now, what about, you had mentioned earlier that this little guy, when you're 2 years old, left your room and headed toward in the direction of your brother's room, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Now,
so it seemed, yep.
Yeah, it would seem. So, do you know if your brother ever reported, or any other family members ever reported such goings-on?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing in my family. I'm the youngest of five boys. My two oldest brothers have had many very strange experiences. The two brothers after them, nothing at all.
Hmm.
So three out of the five boys have had a very high number of strange experiences happen, and then for some reason the other two They really haven't had anything happen to them. Now, the two oldest in the family, my two oldest brothers, and I do go into a lot of their events that have happened to them in the book, so I won't go too far in hopes that somebody will be interested in seeing their stories in the proper context. Mm-hmm. But, my oldest brother, he was known as, in the family, the psychic one and the one who encountered ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
The second oldest brother, he had quite a talent for out-of-body experience. He could willingly leave his body and go places.
Could willingly do it.
Mm-hmm.
And did he seem to enjoy this and want to do it again?
There's some stories of his adventures in the book. He was in the Marines when he did most of his out-of-body experiences. There was actually a book in on the ship he was in.
Mm-hmm.
And on how to do out-of-body experiences. Yeah, and he's like, well, this is a weird book to have here on the ship. So he read it and tried it, and sure enough, he was moving through, passing through walls, going to other ships, leaving the ship he was on, which was stationed in the Philippines at the time.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, he had a great time for a while.
I want to know that book. I want to read that book.
Yeah.
Because I've had a couple of out-of-body experiences in my life, but they were pretty much accidental, except the first one where I actually tried to do it, succeeded in doing it, and couldn't do it on command thereafter. So I'd like to read that book.
Yeah, I did try to find out from him which book it was, and he's like, no, I don't know. It was a long time ago. And so I do have some books in my library, and I've tried myself to intentionally go out of body.
Mm-hmm.
With pretty flat results. Yeah, I don't really.
Well, I kind of got the impression in your book that you weren't happy with doing these out of body experiences. You tried to fight it. At one point, you tried to fight it, didn't you?
Right, right. When somebody wakes you up in them, now, okay, so, you know, I'll just say, you know, out, you know, to the listening audience right there, you know, right out there right now. Okay, so you're listening to this and saying, out-of-body experience, that sounds so cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sounds like the greatest thing ever. I want to do it. So now imagine that tonight somebody wakes you up at 3:30 in the morning and tries to drag you out of your body. and that is not the way to go about it. So,
no.
So it's terrifying. You don't, you know, when anybody just even wakes you up at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're disoriented as you are in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's very scary. You don't know what's going on. It's terrible. It's horrifying. But if you were able to actually do it yourself, say, like, right now I'm going to lay down and initiate an out-of-body experience,
mm-hmm.
you've sort of got that courage. You've got that sort of consciousness already with mm-hmm. you, and you're a little bit in control.
Willingness,
so,
yeah.
So that would be pretty cool, but it doesn't tend, you know, with me, it never really happened that way. I could never make it happen myself.
Mm.
It only happened to me at the worst times.
Mm.
And much of my thought was, well, if I can initiate this, if I can do it myself, if I can control it, maybe it won't be as scary.
Right. But I'll bet it would still be as scary if some little gray guy with big buggy eyes was trying to drag you out of your body, right?
Right.
Yeah, I would suppose. Now, a lot of people say that all of this is just a matter of sleep paralysis, a sleep disorder. And you actually went through a sleep study at mm-hmm. Michigan State University, is that correct?
Wayne State, yeah.
Wayne State University, excuse me.
Yep.
But Wayne State University. And what happened in that situation? What did they find?
The participants up in the two groups, they were welcoming people who'd said they, like myself, that they'd had abduction experiences, and they also accepted a control group. Now, I never saw anybody else in the study, so I don't know the type of people that were supposedly in my camp or in the control camp, but I stayed a grand total of three nights at Detroit Receiving Hospital, where they wired me up from head to toe. There's a picture of me with a lot of the visible wires anyway in the book. And so what they would do is they would monitor how long I was in REM sleep, how long it took me to go to sleep, possibly if I woke up a great number of times during the night. So they sort of got a level of my sleep pattern for, you know, at the beginning. And then what they did, and they told me they were going to do this, is they were going to, at the end, they woke me up in the middle of the night to see if I would either mistake that as some sort of high strangeness experience, or maybe in that semi-lucid state where I was going back to sleep, maybe I would report something that seemed like an abduction experience.
I see.
Now, the thing is that I was so heavily wired from, like I said, head to foot, that any time I moved, I was bumping into one of these wires or pulling one of the wires that was taped on me off, or I had very limited movement. It was not a comfortable sleep situation at all.
Hmm.
So it wasn't, I think, on the face of it, a great test, really, just on those grounds alone. However, I will say that when we were done with the study, they reported the results to me that I slept better and more naturally than several people in the control sample did.
Right.
I not only slept better than the other quote-unquote abductees in their group, whoever they were, but also several people in the control. So,
So bottom line, you claimed to be an abductee. They said, okay, we'd like to test you. They tested you, and they said, you're more normal than the rest of them, right?
Right, so they were looking for some sort of fingerprints of a sleep disorder, and I had nothing to give them.
Right. Has there ever been third-party confirmation of your UFO sightings, let alone your abductions? I know abductions are a very rare third-party confirmation, although there is witnessed abductions. But what about seeing UFOs?
Well, both, actually.
Oh, really?
The sighting is something that's covered in my my current book. The abduction is something that is going to appear probably in my next book.
Well, give us a little preview, then.
Mm-hmm. I'll touch on the sighting very briefly, and then I'll go into depth with the other situation, the abduction situation.
Okay.
For the sighting, it was me and a couple buddies. We were in high school in our senior year, and a blue ball of light about the size of a car arced over the car that we were in. We were parked at the time waiting for another friend to come home from work. So this big blue ball of light flew slowly, sort of tumbling over our car. Then, as it crossed over the horizon, then a white light came, and this white light shot and zigzagged all crazy all over the sky, and then that vanished, and then a red light appeared in the middle of the sky. We all saw it, and strangely enough, a couple of very large military airplanes flew overhead right directly after, which made it even all the more puzzling.
Hmm.
And then the next day at work, there was one of my coworkers who actually had seen the blue ball of light followed by one of the large military aircraft, about a half hour different in time from when I saw it.
Okay.
So that was pretty strange. In terms of the abduction event, and again, I don't know if abduction fully works as a right term because we weren't taken. However, I'll go in greater depth when I actually get it down in the book. But the shortened version of the day's events were that I was on a date with this girl. We had just been dating probably about 2 months at that time. And we were in a park, and we were doing some quote-unquote stargazing, And at night, we stayed. We went to the park during the daytime, stayed and watched the sunset, and then stargazing. So while we were there, kind of more interested in each other than what was going on in the sky, suddenly the whole park became very quiet. There were some noises around us, like things like birds or insects or just sort of natural forest sounds that all suddenly were completely quiet all of a sudden. And as we got up to leave, suddenly we were both frozen in place, and three little gray guys came up, and they went up to my date, and they observed her very carefully, and I could tell they didn't really like her very much. And they were very disapproving.
Did you tell them, hey, that's my date, you know, I don't care if you like it? Go ahead with your story.
So immediately after they went away, they left the scene, and then we were able to move again. And I'm giving, again, a somewhat edited version of this because it does take a while to really unfold at its rightful pace and everything.
That
is going to be in the book. But after they left, she was completely freaked out, and I was freaked out too, but... I was also mad at myself because with my lifelong of experiences with these little guys, I'm like, oh my gosh, here I am, a complete idiot. I bring this girl out in, you know, completely vulnerable area in the, you know, and it's nighttime and there's nobody around. And, you know, I felt like I had walked into a trap pretty much.
Yeah.
And so she, like I said, was completely freaking out. And so, as we went home, rather than drop her off at home directly, we went to a store that was open. We went actually to a Meijer store, and we went inside, and we just wanted to be around a lot of people, see normal things like, you know, that you see on store shelves, and we were even in the pet department for a while trying to just absorb as much normalcy as possible,
right?
Because what had happened was obviously
not
traumatic for me, but way overly traumatic for her. And we broke up pretty much right after, and that night certainly had a great deal to do with it.
Had you told her about your experiences?
No,
you hadn't. So that wouldn't have been a reason for her to break up with you then.
Well, if I'd told her about the experiences,
right?
I don't know.
Especially,
I never got that.
Especially after this experience, where she was so traumatically, traumatic experience, and then you tell her, "Well, I've been around him all my life," and she say, "Well, I'm not going to be around him all my life," right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
Yeah, there's always that point. You know, when you're dating somebody,
right,
when you have these type of experiences,
right,
where you decide to tell them, or in some cases, you know, they become a participant. But, you know, for me at that point with that girl, it was just a little bit too early for me to have felt open enough to say anything.
Right.
But it sure didn't stop them.
Right. Well, Bill, tell us where we can check out your book, Experiencer, Raised in Two Worlds.
It's on Amazon.com, and Barnes & Noble also sells it, online at least anyway.
Yeah.
The best place probably to go to look for it, because it has a little bit more of my experience stuff on it, is my website.
Which is
experiencer.me, and that's M-E.
Okay.
And, that's my website. There's links to it directly to the book, as well as some more background information on me and some other information. I have a blog that I contribute to about once a month. I don't have the time to be able to devote to it on a daily or even weekly basis with my schedule, but I'm sure, you know, I try to get to it at least once a month and put my thoughts down for the month.
Right. Very good. And check out the book and check out MUFON, MUFON.com and MUFON, MIMUFON.org. And Mr. Bill Konkoleski, I want to thank you very much for joining us this evening on We Are Not Alone.
Thank you, Dave.
And I hope we can do it again. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at blackfaultradionetwork.com, as well as on my website, ufoimplications.com. That's ufoimplications.com. Please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Hey, it's Brian from the Verve Pipe, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Happy Groundhog's Day to you, and welcome to another great edition of One Chord to Another. I'm your host, Jeff, and I'll be here with you for the next 2 hours playing new and slightly used indie rock and pop. I've got lots of great music today, and in just a little bit, I'll let you know if that little groundhog predicted an early spring or even more winter. I'm hoping for less winter here, but we'll see. I'll get into the music in just a minute, but